and welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome National Book Award winner Kimberly Willis Holt to the program today. She won the award for Young People's Literature in 1999 for her novel When Zachary Beaver Came to Town. Henry Holt & Company recently released her novel Dear Hank Williams, which is set in Louisiana in the late 1940s. Tate P. Ellerbe is beginning a new school year, and her new teacher, Mrs. Kipler, wants all the students to get a pen pal to write to. And Tate's got a pretty ambitious choice for her pen pal, doesn't she?
She does. She's going to write to Hank Williams. She heard him on the Louisiana Hayride and is smitten, you know, with his music and his voice and his lyrics. And so when the teacher makes that assignment for them to have pen pals and tells them that she's got pen pals in mind, she decides she's going to choose her own, and she's going to write to Hank Williams.
Mrs. Kipler wants the children to have pen pals that live in Japan, and this is just 3 years after World War II.
Right. I'm sure some people are going to have a hard time believing that, but it came from truth. I was talking to my Aunt Barbara, who was about the same age as Tate in that year, and I asked her if she remembered any childhood memories. You know, maybe I could use them in the story, or maybe it would inspire something in the story. And she said, well, I remember my fourth grade teacher got us Japanese pen pals. And I was astonished by that because she lived in a small town. My mom grew up in the same place, Forest Hill, Louisiana, very small town. And this is right after the war. You know, the fact that a teacher had the insight to get children to write to what had been our enemies just a few years before. But I think she was bridging a gap, building a bridge over a river of hate is what she was doing. But it's just amazing to me because I did some research to try to find out if there was some type of organization or a movement that started this, because I kept finding other occurrences of people that had Japanese pen pals. Some had kept writing them through the years, and even as elderly people went and visited their pen pal, either in Japan or the pen pal came over to America. But I never could find the source. So I don't know if this was just all these progressive teachers were acting independently, or if there really was an organization or some type of a movement. I'd love to know that. But for my sake, it helped me in the story, because that's really also what formed the letters in the story. I started thinking Tate could have a pen pal, he could be Hank Williams, and she could use him like a journal. She would be writing to him, hoping that he would write her, but at some point, it doesn't matter, because she knows her secret's going to be safe with him.
And let's pull out a 10-cent word. It's an epistolary novel.
It is epistolary novel.
So it is told through Tate's letters.
It is.
In that, we see that she has a particular view of her truth that she gives to Hank Williams. So we know that there could be something that she's holding back from Hank. She's not going to tell him every secret that she has.
That's right. You know, in the beginning, maybe young readers might not recognize that Tate is not telling the entire truth. In fact, I guess you could say she even tells some whoppers, saying that her mother's a movie star, that her father is a famous photographer who takes not only pictures in Africa, but also of blue ribbons, pickles at the World Fair. But I think young readers will discover the truth along with Tate being able to face it herself. But she's an optimist. And so when she is able to face that pain, she deals with it in the way an optimist would. She gets on with things.
And she's very much an optimist because she wants to enter the upcoming talent competition the next spring. And not a lot of people have confidence in her voice.
That's right. You know, I think this is a good example of practice makes perfect. What is that, 10,000 hours that Malcolm Gladwell says he said? And I think this is an example because she practices and practices and practices. And all her relatives that have heard her sing, they only know what they remember prior to all that practice. And she's been practicing in secret by the magnolia tree. She improves herself.
And she's determined.
She is very determined. Yeah, we can learn something from Tate.
Her rival, especially when it comes to singing, is a little girl named Verbia.
Yes.
And has there been a more unlikable girl since Nellie Olson than Verbia?
You know, I think there's a few sprinkled here and there, unfortunately. You know, I remember a few. Or you see people, I remember as a child, you think, gosh, they get adored. People, and they don't even really see who that person is. They can't sing, you know, but their looks allow them to get away with a lot more. Or where they are in town, you know, maybe they're the wealthy people's child or something. So, yeah, I think there's a Verbia or two here or there.
But there's plenty of grown-ups that are mean in secret and kind in public, too.
Well, and I think that she witnesses that a little bit. But again, she's able to deal with it. And yeah, it hurts, but she doesn't stay there. She doesn't stay in that hurtful place. She moves on.
Now, Tate lives in Rippling Creek, Louisiana. What kind of town is Rippling Creek?
Rippling Creek is Forest Hill, Louisiana. I use Forest Hill, Louisiana, where my ancestors have lived, my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents. Seven generations of both sides of my family are from central Louisiana, and Forest Hill is in central Louisiana. And it is the place that I've used a lot. I was telling kids today, you know, you have a well of your life, and you will always have something to write about it, because everything in your life that happened to you, good and bad, is in that well. All the people you love are in that well. The people you don't love are in that well. But Forest Hill, Louisiana is definitely in my well, because I've used it in several books of mine. And I usually change the name of the town because it gives me some creative liberty.
In reading your bio that your father was in the Navy and you had to move around a lot as a child, how do you get that sense to give to Tate about kind of being stuck in a small town and being kind of hostage to your family's history?
I feel like I have had that experience through my parents. My parents are storytellers, and I always felt like their lives were real to me. Their childhoods are real to me. I wanted to know about what my parents' childhoods were like, and they always told us, and they told us about the people that live in the town. I'm like that more than my sisters. You know, when I go back to Forest Hill, I know those people, and I'm interested in those people, even though I only lived among them for a little while. And I did live there about 9 months when I was a freshman, the summer before my freshman year, and then part of my freshman year. My family, my mother and my sisters, and I lived in a trailer next to my grandparents' house while my dad was stationed in D.C. before we moved to New Orleans. So I got a taste of what it was like, and that was the childhood I wanted. You know, I lived all over the world. I got a lot of opportunities a lot of people don't have, even as adults, but I wanted that childhood. I wanted to live in the country, in the small town. So it wasn't hard for me at all. It felt very natural to be able to talk about that area. And what I didn't know, I asked my parents.
So Tate's fascination with Hank Williams is something that she cherishes. The Louisiana Hayride was a brand new show at the time. It had only been on the air for a few months. Hank had just signed with MGM Records, so he was a new commodity when it came to putting out records. So she feels really fiercely loyal, and she thinks she's the only Hank Williams fan.
That's right. And I think she wants him to be famous. She keeps telling him, boy, you're going to get famous. I just know you're going to be famous. She's always, you know, saying that, and he is starting to get famous. So when she meets a couple of other fans, when she's mailing a letter, she realizes she's a little jealous about that, until the optimist in her goes, you know what? This is just what I predicted. You are getting famous. See, that was proof of it.
Her uncle Jolly lives in the house. He doesn't think much of Move It On Over. He doesn't like those up-tempo numbers.
He only likes lovesick songs.
Because he has the worst trouble with women.
He does. He does. I love Uncle Jolly. I was happy for Uncle Jolly when Garnet came into his life. Yeah, he has bad luck with women. You know, I wanted him to have somebody that was special. So it was fun to write Garnet. I had to be careful as a writer. When Garnet came into my first draft, for a while it was Garnet's story, because I loved her so much. You know, I love the kind of person she was. She was perfect for him.
Tate and her little brother Frog actually live with their aunt, and that's Aunt Patty Cake.
Right.
And please tell me that Patty Cake is a real name and not something you made up.
I took it from someone.
Good.
Her name is not Patty Cake.
Oh.
Okay. But I mean, that's her nickname, and that it just stuck. You know how it is in the South. We all have to have a nickname. And one of the librarian friends of mine, I noticed on her email address, part of it said Patty Cake, and I thought that was so cute. And so I decided I would use that. And it's so funny, because when she read an early copy of the book, an advanced copy, she said, oh, and you have an Aunt Patty Cake. She goes, that's my name. And I said, guess where I got it? Got it from you. Yeah.
Well, what was your little nickname when you were growing up?
Kimbo. It still Kimbo? Is with my family. Kimbo. Yeah, I'm Aunt Kimbo.
On a side note, I have a friend. And back when the Spice Girls were popular, they would call her Kimmy Spice.
Yes.
And then there was this mixed martial arts fighter named Kimbo Slice.
Oh.
So I started calling her Kimbo Spice.
Oh, no. I like that. Okay, I could handle that one, too. Okay.
Now, what kind of boy is Frog?
A pest. You know, when I was writing about Frog, it was easy to do because I'm the oldest, like Tate. I had two sisters. One was 11 years younger than me, and she was like a baby doll to me. She could do no wrong. But the one that was 3 years younger than me, we were so opposite. And She was such a pest that, give you an example, when she started dating, she paid my youngest sister to leave her alone because she didn't want her to do what she had done to me. So, you know, Frog is a quiet kind of young man, a little boy. He dreams of knowing his dad. He walks around in his dad's boots. The father's not in the picture anymore, and he left these old boots behind.
He's a bit timid, too.
He is a bit timid. He's afraid of everything he shouldn't be afraid of. And he's brave when he shouldn't be.
Aunt Patty Cake, to make ends meet, sells delightfully divine cosmetics. It's kind of like a Mary Kay type setup. You must have had so much fun coming up with the product names.
I did, and I have to tell you where that came from. My grandmother sold Avon for about 40 years. And I can remember riding with, I was not her model. Tate is a cosmetic model for Aunt Patty Cake because Aunt Patty Cake doesn't wear makeup herself except for a little swipe of lipstick. But my grandmother sold Avon and she had, you know, lived in the country. And so we would get in the car and go with her on that Avon route. And that was her way of visiting too. It was fun. You always got a cup of coffee. I mean, or she did. And they would talk. And oh, yeah, we'll order some lipstick too. You know, it was that kind of thing. I wanted to use Avon. They definitely had Avon products then, but I could never document how they were sold. And I started realizing how much research that was going to take and how limiting it was. And so that's why I came up with the Delightfully Divine Beauty products. And I had more fun with it because it was fun to think up the different names.
So it sounds like you do a lot of very intense research for your books.
I do. I want it to sound truthful in the places where it needs to be truthful. That's why when Hank Williams, even though he never writes her back, I needed to know what was going on in his life while he was at the Louisiana Hayride. So I have a timeline, you know, where I write out, you know, when he sang a certain song. Lovesick Blues was his big hit that really made him famous nationwide. And, you know, that's just one example. Just different things helped me so that she could be mentioning certain things that she heard him say or sing on the radio.
Did you ever have any pause in using Hank Williams since he had that tragic end that involved so many drugs and alcohol?
I thought about that because I thought, what if kids go? Nobody's asked me yet, though. Well, what happened to him? They haven't. And, you know, that did cause me to think, should I use him? But sometimes it's as if something happens and it feels like a confirmation. And the way Hank Williams entered the story, I was driving to my grandfather's house. I wrote this story at his house because he was at the Louisiana War Veterans Home and his house was empty. And he told me I could go right there. I needed to get away. And I was there 3 weeks. And on the way there, Hank Williams was not in my head. But the Gory Girls were, living across the street from the cemetery was, but not Hank Williams. It was still real early on. But I knew Louisiana Hayride was going to play a role in it because of the time period, that they would be listening to it, and it would be special to her. So I was listening to some CDs I got that had the Louisiana Hayride perform, some of them on there. Hank Williams was on it, and we were big fans of Hank Williams. In fact, my sister was a real big fan. She had an album, and I actually broke it. I was mad at her one time, and I replaced it about 10 years ago from eBay. Thank goodness eBay. This was a long, long time ago when I broke it on purpose. Anyway, we were big fans of Hank Williams. And I thought, I think she's going to like Hank Williams. So I wanted him to be part of it after that, just even if it was just going to be barely mentioned. When I got to my grandparents' house, they still have an old-timey record player, you know, the kind where it lifts the top up. It looks like a big box in the room. And I opened up and looked through the albums, and there was a Hank Williams album. And I thought, okay, there's my confirmation. That means I'm supposed to use him. But it did. Sure, I did have some concerns. And all you can do is answer that question. If somebody does ask what happened to him, or I've heard this is what happened to him, you just answer it straight on.
It's not like you shy away from the other rough things in life in the story either. There are a lot of traumatic experiences that are just everyday occurrences for these people.
It is. I know there are for other children too. There are children that have parents that are in prison. You know, there are children that the father took off and is no longer a part of their life. So I'm hoping that this story is for them too, that they see somebody as optimistic as Tate, you know, that can make the best of a bad situation.
So when you're writing about a period coming on 70 years ago, just about, How do you write that to make sure the children of today are able to access and kind of understand that time better?
That's a good question. Well, one of the things that I do is I, through the research, is you do start thinking about, okay, would a kid today know what a Victrola was? You have to describe it in a way, explain it in a way that seems natural, but yet explains what it is. There's no denying there are opportunities in this story for teachers to explain certain details about it, but you have to be true to the time period too. But I think what they will relate to is that Tay wants the same things that they do. She wants to be happy. A lot of kids want to be famous, do what they love, whether it's sports or play the piano or sing or just collect stamps. You know, people want to do what they love the most. And so I think that's where they're going to relate to it. And I think they're going to relate to it, hopefully, on an emotional level, too.
When we write about the past, okay, we're actually writing about today, and that we're making commentaries on our contemporary life by when we're writing historical fiction. Because the things that we will pay attention to,
right,
in things in the past are things that are...
Okay, here's a good example. The pen pal situation, where the teachers that had the forethought to put children in contact with each other through writing to them from war-torn countries. One of my friends that got an advanced copy of the book, she said, I want to get my class pen pals. And so she did, but she was going to give them another situation that was very similar to the kids, that the kids were already living in, a very similar situation. And I said, let me find an international school, because I've gone to a lot of international schools. They're writing to a school in the Middle East. It's a school, it's called the American School of Doha in Qatar. Here you have rural Tennessee kids writing to a class of children that have been to different countries, you know, speak different languages. And I told those kids, because I Skyped with the Tennessee kids, because they finished, you know, before the other kids did, because they were nervous, I'd heard, about writing to them, because they said, or my teacher friend said, you know, these kids haven't gone anywhere. And I spoke to that a little bit. I said, look, they want your life. I went around the world because of my dad's career, but I wanted your life. I wanted to live in that little town, you know, with my grandparents and in the country. I said, so you will seem exotic to them. That's going to seem really different. It gives them two different experiences. And I think you can look at the Middle East now the same way that they were looking at Japan. So to me, in many ways, it was the perfect match. So I think that, you know, if you look at the simplest things, like writing a letter to someone who has a total different life, it can bridge over a river of hate.
And I think another thing that's kind of germane to our current situation is there is a character whose parent is in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And now with incarceration rates being as high as they've ever been in America, that there are a lot of children who have to face their parents being in prison.
Right.
Did you do any research on children whose parents were in prison at all? Or
just that, well, the only thing that I really used, to be honest with you, is the Gory Girl article that I read by Skip Hollinsworth in Texas Monthly. Those women became celebrities, and they had people writing letters on their behalf that didn't know them. They were fans of theirs, asking them to please shorten their sentences, to let them out. These were good women. Can't you hear it in their voices? That happened, and I do use that in the story. You know, one of the reasons that I write is that I want to be in other people's skin, and I'm pretty good about doing that, I think, and being able to see through other people's eyes and what they're emotionally going through. But I've certainly known children through my mother. My mother was a teacher, a special ed teacher in a rural town in Oklahoma, and this can happen. I'm saying rural towns just because that's my background with my mom being a teacher and my friend that teaches. But in both cases, they had people, you know, students that their parents were in prison. One of their parents was. My friend that read it to a class of children, one of the children has a father that's in prison. One of the children also had a grandmother who was in prison. That was one of the questions when I Skyped. One little girl said, why does Tate's mother have to be in prison? But I don't have to do research to know that heartbreak.
And one of the difficult things that you do address in the book, in a small way, are race relations. I mean, this is the South in the 1940s, so it's still the height of Jim Crow, essentially, at this time. So how does Aunt Patty Cake get her orders from the African-American community when she's not really able to travel there?
Well, she could travel there. She chooses not to travel there. And there's a lady there that decides that she's going to get the orders from her neighbors and go to her Aunt Patty Cake's house and give Aunt Patty Cake the orders. It's almost like it's understood, and that came from truth.
And her name is Constance, yeah. And she often brings her daughter Zion along with her.
Right.
And Zion and Frog seem to have this kind of weird relationship.
They do. Yeah, Zion and Frog definitely have a interesting relationship.
Because he's always hiding from her, and she's always asking after him. And
that's right. And Tate is a little annoyed with Zion early on, because Zion says something very smart to Tate.
About the singing?
About the singing. When Tate starts to practice a song in front of her, and she just looks at her, and then after she's done, she said, "Was your heart in that song? Were you all quivery when you sang that song?" And she says, "Well, no, I wasn't nervous." And she said, "That's what I thought. My daddy says you've got to put your heart in it, you know, and be a little bit nervous when you're singing. You got to care about it." And she was very taken back by that, you know, but Zion was right. And she learns what that means, to really put your heart into something.
And putting your heart in something means opening your heart up and being vulnerable.
That's right. Exactly.
Now, a little bit later on in the story, we learn about Catahoula leopard dogs. Well, one pops up in the story. What in the heck is a Catahoula leopard dog?
Well, a cur dog.
A cur dog.
A lot of people may know them as cur dogs. When I was writing this story, I went and visited another aunt and uncle, and there was a cur dog at my aunt's feet, and it belongs to my cousin. And I'd seen cur dogs before. I didn't know there was a name for them. You know, they look like a lot of the dogs that I see out in the country. But it had the most beautiful glass eyes. I said, "What kind of dog is this?" And she said, "It's a Louisiana cur dog." And I said, "A cur dog?" And she goes, "Well, they're called Louisiana Catahoulas, but everybody around here says cur dog." And she said, "A lot of people are afraid of it because of its eyes, but I thought the eyes were amazing." And so I knew that I was going to have a cur dog in this story.
Because for the rest of the country, cur kind of has like a negative connotation to it, I think.
I didn't know that. You mean mixed? Because it's kind of like mixed or what?
It's an insult to call a man a cur. He's a rounder. He's a bit of a bad seed if he's a cur.
I'm just trying to call it like I hear. That's what people out there say.
We've talked about, you have all these great little details in the story, like Mrs. Applebutt going to the cemetery every day.
Well, I used to go on cemetery walks with my grandfather, my dad's dad, a lot. In fact, I've gone to cemeteries with my other grandfather as well. But my dad's dad was a big talker. So he knew every single person in the cemetery, and he knew a story behind them. He may have not known them personally. They may have died before he was even born, but he knew who they were, who their people were, why they died or how they died. And it was fascinating. I was never afraid of going to cemeteries because of him and those cemetery walks. I've done a cemetery walk with a grandfather and a granddaughter in another story. So cemeteries seem to pop up in my books, but I don't have a situation that like Tate has and Miss Applebud has, where they go and they visit all the time. But I know there are people that do that. You know, you'll see those graves that are always meticulous. They always have flowers on them. And it's because somebody in the family makes it their duty to go. When my maternal grandmother died, my grandfather, who's a gardener, there was a camellia tree near it. And I know when he and my mother went there, he said he was upset because the camellia needed pruning, the tree, and he asked if he could prune it for them, and they let him prune it. It didn't belong to him. It just was near it. And so I think visiting cemeteries, they are a way of celebrating life and paying your respects to the ones that have passed on. And I guess that did come from my family.
But are there any little details that you put in the book that you just made up out of whole cloth instead of having like these real world antecedents for them?
I thought the whole book was made up.
Well, the plot, but you have all these nice details.
Okay.
And it seems like almost every little detail I ask you about has this nice story behind it.
Oh, yeah, I know. It does, doesn't it? Because that comes from that well I'm telling you about, you know, I told the kids about. I had to imagine what it was like to have a Japanese pen pal, you know, that maybe something like that. You know, and that comes from my aunt, though. You're right. Everything comes, I guess it is hard to find something that can't be pinned to something else in my life or from someone I know.
So are you a writer or a miner?
You know what? I think I'm a miner. I do. Thanks for putting that straight. Okay.
So when you're talking with the students, do you play Hank Williams music for them? And what are their reactions?
Well, the book's only been out a week. But some of the schools that I've visited have been doing that. And I'm going to add that in because I think that's a great idea, or at least it suggests that they do it before I come for the visit.
So what would be your top three Hank Williams songs?
Well, unfortunately, most of the songs I love by him are songs that he wrote after the Louisiana Hayride. I love I'm So Lonesome I Could Die. That is a beautiful song. I love Elijah, Jambalaya. I mean, I could go on and on. Yeah.
Those first two you listed, I think those were among the last songs he wrote before he passed away.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Those are my favorites, though. Definitely I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. That just to hear him sing it makes you want to cry.
Just on a side note, I was talking to a friend the other day. There was a Mo Bandy from his album, Bandy the Rodeo Clan. He had a song called Hank Williams, You Wrote My Life. And it says, you wrote your cheating heart about a girl like my first ex-wife.
Oh, no. Oh gosh.
I just love that line so much.
That is great. That's great. I think he speaks to a lot of our hearts.
It was apparent when Norah Jones became such a sensation about 15 years ago that Cold, Cold Heart was one of those songs that
that's
just
right.
was one of the things that launched
that's
her
That's a beautiful
success.
Song. You're right. Both versions.
Now, you've won the National Book Award. Mm-hmm. That is a huge, huge honor. How did that change your career?
Well, I think for a little while, it felt like more people knew a book of mine when I went places. Like when I went to schools, you know, it was recognized. It still is that book. I mean, that's of my books. That's still a lot of people's favorite.
And that's when Zachary Beaver came to
mm-hmm.
town.
I got invited to a lot more schools, conferences. So in a sense, it gave me a platform, you know, to speak to students, and that's exciting. It gives you a lot more recognition in that on that front. There's still a lot of people that don't even know what a National Book Award is, unfortunately. And so, you know, I get quite often, now, what's that award you won? You know, and that's good. It brings you down to earth. I always like to tell about the day I learned I was a finalist, and I was out of town visiting schools. And when I learned, I called and told my husband, I said, don't tell our daughter. I want to tell her. And so she got on the phone, and I said, guess what? I'm a finalist for the National Book Award. And she said, that's nice, Mama. She goes, Mama, my choir dress does not fit. I love that story. It's like, okay, this is what it's really about. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah.
So I hate to ask this with just 1 week since the book has come out, but do you have thoughts on your next project?
I'm already working on it. Yes, I have been working on it for, I guess, about a year now. And it's set in Texas. I tend to go to Louisiana and Texas a lot in my stories. And I live in Texas, so that makes it a little bit easier to research. But I don't want to speak to anything about it except for that, because sometimes I change titles, sometimes I change what the book is about. And if I talk about it too much, I won't want to write it. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing your book with
you.
Us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me, Stephen. Appreciate it.
Kimberly Willis Holt is the author of Dear Hank Williams, which is published by Henry Holt & Company. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee. 38111 or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.